Good morning. Today's going to be a little bit more. I told you this was a seminary style sermon series. Today is definitely probably the most seminary oriented approach to just a few verses. I stumbled across a very interesting statement this week as I was preparing for this message. And the statement was this. It was written by Bible scholar John Walton. If you've been intrigued by this series so far, and you would really like to explore the depths of the first 11 chapters of Genesis, John Walton is a guy I would recommend reading. He's written several books that really plumb the depths of the topic. But he makes the statement that the Bible was written for us all, but it was not written to us. And I kind of ruminated on that statement. The Bible was written for us all, but it was not written to us. And I think when we approach, especially chapters like Genesis chapter 6, we run into some difficulty when we approach the text with the mindset that the Bible was written directly to us. Because I do agree with Walton, the Bible was not written to us, it was written for us. It was written to a completely different audience. The people, the ancient people that this was written directly to, their minds worked way different than our minds. There's a huge difference between the Eastern mind and the Western mind. And we're all Westerners. So the original audience is important to understand when we come to all of Genesis, but especially today, Genesis 6. Another author that I read stated that it was common practice in the ancient world to use an event or the memory of an event and retell it in a figurative way to communicate a message to the hearers. So I think what's going on here in Genesis chapter 6, as we get through chapter 6 through chapter 9, there's a retelling of a story. There's a retelling of an event or the memory of an event that has a message for all of mankind, not just the original audience, but there's a message for us today. And here's why I say that I believe this is a memorable, cataclysmic event in human history. Because if you do the research, there are over 270 nations or tribes that include flood stories in their history. So think about that. Across the world, 270 nations or tribes have their own version of a flood story. So at a minimum, this would lead me to believe that there's a widely held memory of a cataclysmic flood. There's two in particular flood stories, the Epic of Gilgamesh and the Atrahasis Epic. They both tell flood stories. And it's really no dispute when they unearthed these stories, the Babylonian flood account, the Epic of Gilgamesh, predates Genesis. It was written prior to Genesis. And they're really similar. There's some similarities that can't be overlooked. And Gilgamesh and Atrahasis, they're pretty close. It seems like maybe Gilgamesh even copies the Atrahasis epic. But here's what you need to know about some of these. Gilgamesh is about a man named Gilgamesh. He's on a quest to find immortality. He doesn't like the thought that he's going to die as a human. So to make a long story short, he ends up searching for and finding a man who has attained immortality. That man's name is Utnapishtim. And the way that Utnapishtim attained immortality is that he survived a flood by building a boat. So Utnapishtim is the guy in the Epic of Gilgamesh that's similar to Noah. Now, one of the things we talked about when we started this series, especially when we talked about Genesis 1 and 2 in particular, is that there's a polemic approach to this text. What that means is Moses, I believe, wrote this account in such a way as to counter what these other cultures had written about God or the gods and creation. And so the difference between Genesis 6 through 9, the story of the flood, and all these other flood stories is that in these other pagan accounts, the primary focus is the hero. Utnapishtim is the primary focus. But in the story in Genesis 6 through 9, the primary focus is on the act of God, not the act of man. Big difference. In these 270 different accounts of flood stories, 88% of those flood stories say that there was a favored family that was spared. 70% say that survival was by the means of a boat. 63% say that the flood was a result of man's wickedness outside of the Babylonian accounts. The Babylonian accounts, that's not the cause of the flood. The cause of the floods is that humankind annoy the gods. They get on the gods' nerves, and the gods can't sleep because they're too loud. So they flood the earth. And then many of these accounts speak about a rainbow. So isn't that fascinating? Now, my intent today was I wanted to cover the flood, the whole entire thing, but I realized pretty quickly that I was biting off more than I could chew. So we're only going to cover 9 verses today, chapter 6, verses 1 through 9, because in those 9 verses, there's a lot of questions for modern readers. So I'm doing something different. You'll notice I have my laptop up here. I don't typically do this. I want to do this so I can have a side-by-side reading. I'm going to do the NIV and the New American Standard because there's some significant differences today in words that are used between the two translations. So we're just going to read the first 3 verses together. And if we have time, I might open this up for questions afterwards because it gets kind of hairy. When human beings began to increase, this is the NIV. When human beings began to increase in number on the earth and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of humans were beautiful, and they married any of them they chose. Then the Lord said, "My spirit will not contend with humans forever, for they are mortal. Their days will be 120 years." So right off the bat, I think we get to one of the questions that's often asked when we read just these few verses is who or what are the sons of God? And we spend a lot of time dwelling on these types of questions. Who are these beings? Are they people? Are they not people? And so what I want to do in just these first 3 verses, I want to discuss some of the views that revolve around these sons of God. The Hebrew term is B'nai HaElohim, which it just means sons of God, or there's a lot of different translations for that word Elohim. Luckily for you, I have 2 copies of a paper that I wrote in seminary that discusses how to interpret the phrase sons of God. So if you like scholarly reading, this is my attempt at a scholarly writing from seminary. If 2 copies aren't enough, I'll make duplicates for people, but feel free to come up here afterwards, grab that. It's 15 pages, real short read. You can get through it in no time. But Elohim, this term Elohim can be interpreted as God, and this is the most common, the most frequent interpretation in the Old Testament that we have. When we see Elohim, it's plural in meaning, but it means for us one single God. It's also interpreted as angels or in other religions, lesser gods or demigods. But in the Old Testament, it's also translated as judge or king. So because there's so many different ways that this one word can be translated, there's several different views that are out there circulating about what's really going on here. I mean, who are these sons of God that see these daughters of humans and marry them? So the first view is this, and this is a really common view, is that these sons of God are angels who are copulating with humans. I listened to a podcast where an individual was speaking. I can't remember if it was John Walton. It may have been, actually. But the podcast was talking about how this, we get to Genesis 6, and what we see here is a second fall. This is like the fall of spiritual beings. And the fall is these spiritual beings or the divine council attempt to fix the problem that humanity had caused, created through sin. And so this view sees these angelic beings or the divine council coming down and intermarrying with human beings. In Job chapter 1 and Job chapter 2, we see this phrase pop up. Now, the NIV does not translate it this way. The NIV translates Job chapter 1, verse 6 as angels. But the New American Standard version of Job chapter 1, verse 6 translates this phrase the same way as in Genesis 6, 1, sons of God. If you're familiar with Job, it says, the sons of God came and presented them before Yahweh God, and the Satan was with them. And clearly in this text, this is talking about in Job, angelic beings that are coming and standing before God. A New Testament application of this, you get to Jude verses 5 and 6. There's only one chapter in Jude. Jude verses 5 and 6. Some people look at this and say, well, this is talking about what's going on here in Genesis 6. I'll flip over there real quick to Jude. Probably quicker for me to find it in here than it is on the computer. So Jude verses 5 and 6. Though you already know all this, I want to remind you that the Lord at one time delivered his people out of Egypt, but later destroyed those who did not believe. And verse 6, and the angels who did not keep their position of authority but abandoned their proper dwelling, these he has kept in darkness, bound with everlasting chains for the judgment on the great day. And some people look at this and say, this is talking about Genesis 6. These are angels that are coming and cohabitating with people. But there's not enough evidence in Jude to really pinpoint that to Genesis 6. It could just be talking about the fall of angelic beings. Now, there's something that needs to be noted here. Job 1 and Genesis 6 are two completely different settings. Job 1 is in the heavenly realm. Genesis 6 is clearly in the earthly realm. So, can we translate this, sons of God, as being angels? Possibly. The second view is this, that the sons of God are demon-possessed men. Now, demon-possessed men are taking these women and marrying them. And that's pretty straightforward. The third view is that the sons of God are ancient kings. Mesopotamian kings prior to the flood actually considered themselves gods that descended from the heavens. And this is according to Meredith Klein, who's an American theologian. And so we have these three views of who are these people, what's really going on here. Which one's right? You know, all three views have their pros and cons. I think we could argue all three of those views and make it sound pretty good depending on how we argue it. I'll tell you which way I lean toward. I lean toward the third view, that this phrase, sons of God, is talking about ancient kings. Because the context that this falls into, and we get caught up in, oh, these angels, this is some real big mythical thing. But the context this falls into is about humanity. We are exiting out of Genesis 3, 4, and 5, where we know 3 is the fall in the garden, 4 is Cain killing Abel, and 5 is all of these genealogies of humanity. And then we get to this position right here, 6. And it's really all about the wickedness of humankind. So I lean towards this being the fact that ancient kings, kings of old, are the sons of God, and they're going out amongst the common people. And the crime is this. The crime is that they are forcefully taking as many women as they want to be their wives. The women have no choice in the matter. That's what's going on. They are going out. They are forcing women into marriage. And not just one. Lots of women. And so what I think is going on is I think that this text is addressing the issue of what was called a royal harem. Now, you'll know if you read the Old Testament, when we get into the monarchy of Israel, that even these monarchs, these kings, these sons of God, they have harems. I mean, you can read about David. How many wives does David have? That's a harem. And I think this is a text that is attacking that way of life that was common practice. But I want to caution you, we spend some time talking about these views, but I think we get so caught up in the view that we actually miss the main point of what's going on in the text. Right? Because there's a pattern here in this text. What these people are doing, there's a pattern that was started back in the garden. I want you to see this. When the human beings began to increase in number on the earth and the daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of humans were beautiful, and they married any of them they chose. Now listen to the NASB. Now it came about when mankind began to multiply on the face of the land and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw that the daughters of mankind were beautiful. And in the NASB, most of them will have a little asterisk or a footnote that says, here's what this word is. And it's the word tov in Hebrew, and it means good. And they took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. So this word tov that's used here of these women is also the same word that's used in Genesis 1 all seven times when God says, it is good. Okay? It's the same word that Eve used when she looked at the fruit from the tree and saw that it was pleasing to the eye and good for food, tov. And so what's going on is these sons of God are looking and determining something is good outside of God's standard for good. When you go to Genesis 3 and you look at the fall, Eve saw that the fruit was good and took it. When you come to Genesis 6, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were good and they took them. It's the same perpetual pattern of sin that was initiated in the Garden of Eden. And I think that's the main point of the text. The main point isn't to worry about, are they angels? Are they people? What's going on? The main point is there's a pattern that takes place in humanity that leads down a path of destruction. Because as you read the rest of the flood story, what you're going to notice is that humankind is slipping further and further and further back into chaos. Remember how all this started in Genesis 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And remember, the Spirit of God was hovering over the deep abyss, the chaotic waters. And God ordered that chaos into something beautiful. And now what you see with humankind is because, not because they're increasing in number. Remember, that's the mandate. Be fruitful and multiply. They're increasing in number, but as they're increasing in number, their corruption is increasing. The capacity for them to see and take is increasing. And it's leading humanity back down into a deep, dark hole of chaos. So that's the first three verses. Now, just a warning for you here. Verse 4, we get to another biggie. Who are the Nephilim? Verse 4, the Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterward when the sons of God went to the daughters of humans and had children by them. They were the heroes of old, men of renown. Who are these people? Well, this is a noun, Nephilim. It's a noun based off the verb nephal, which means to fall. The fallen ones. There's a view. I'm going to give you four views here, real quick. View number one, these are the offspring of the sons of God and the daughters of men. A lot of people that read this automatically assume that's what's going on here. Because we talked about this cohabitating, these must be the offspring. Hebrew, in the Hebrew, really, it's hard to arrive at that. It does not indicate that these are offspring. It says that they were on the earth in the days that this happened and after the days that this happened. View number two is that these are just people with genetic defects. And why do we talk about that? Because in the ancient world, there was two fates for people with genetic defects, and they're extreme opposites. In the ancient world, if you had a genetic defect, you were either revered as something very special or you were killed at birth. That was the outcome of people with genetic defects. An example would be in Egypt, little people were considered very special. People of small stature. They were revered as something very special. And so one view says that's what's going on here. The Nephilim, in this case, would be really tall people. The third view is that, again, the Nephilim are ancient kings. And then the fourth view is that they're angels, but they're not angels that are cohabitating with humans. These are angels that are acting as gods. And again, we could argue each view, and we could try to sit down and say, this view's right, this view's wrong. But I think there's something else going on here. It appears to me that with both the sons of God phrase and the Nephilim, what's being done is that Moses is beginning to draw a contrast between these two people, the sons of God, the Nephilim, and he's contrasting them to who's coming next, Noah. Because the word that's used to describe these men, heroes of old, men of renown, it's the Hebrew word gabor, which means dread warrior. These people, whoever the Nephilim were, they were warrior kings. And just like the sons of God who are going out and taking women by force, these men of renown are going out and taking people by force. They're capturing people. They're setting up empires, domination systems that are suppressing people. And you say, how do you really get to this? Because when we get to Genesis 11, you're going to see a dread warrior, Nimrod, the empire builder. And this is what he's doing. But I think what is going on here polemically, what Moses is attacking, is when you read the Epic of Gilgamesh, Gilgamesh is an individual who's a king in a city, and he's a terrible king. Because what he does is he goes and finds these people that are getting married, that are about to get married, and he will capture the wife and take her to be his own wife. And he is just wreaking havoc on the kingdom that he reigns over. And so what Moses is doing is he is pointing out right here, he's erasing the name of Gilgamesh. Now that's important historically. If you want to defame somebody, if you want to really shame somebody in the ancient culture, is you get rid of their name out of everything. And it's essentially like erasing them from history. The Egyptians were great at this. I mean, you can find artifacts in Egypt where if they did not like a particular pharaoh, they would chisel off his face, off of his bust, because they don't want people to know. They would chisel the name out of their tablets because that's how you get rid of somebody's memory. And so I think what Moses is doing is he's taking these people in these other stories that were set up on a high pedestal to be the standard of life. These are the ones that we need to attain to. These are the heroes, and he's taking their name out of the picture. Because here's where we go next. The Lord regretted that he had made, this is verse 6. The Lord regretted that he had made human beings on the earth, and his heart was deeply troubled. So the Lord said, I will wipe from the face of the earth the human race I have created, and with them the animals, the birds, and the creatures that move along the ground, for I regret that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. This is the account of Noah and his family. Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time, and he walked faithfully with God. And so there we make that transition. We see that Moses is kind of setting this up, and he's introduced how wicked and how evil people have become. And I like verse 5 where it says, the Lord God saw that all wickedness of mankind was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of their heart was only evil continually. And there's two words that are used that capture it. Really what it means is the little thoughts of people and the big thoughts of people were wickedness. And it's like a mirrorism. What that means is from the littlest thing to the biggest thing and everything in between was evil.
And it indicates that these people were sitting around contemplating evil. They were ruminating over how they could dominate and control other people. And what the result of that is literally, it says, God was grieved to the heart. He had heart pain associated with this. Now we know that this is, you know, God doesn't have a literal heart. But what we should gather from this is that he feels the pain that a person feels. If you've ever been in the middle of grief, if you've been in a situation where you've grieved maybe the loss of a loved one or a close friend, you know that grief can sometimes cause a pain in your heart, where your heart just hurts. And this is God's response to the wickedness of these individuals, this race of people. His heart was pained, and he experienced grief. And what we'll see next week is that this grief and man's sin leads back to chaos. Because the flood story is a decreation story. The flood story is the undoing of everything that God did in Genesis 1 and 2. And so really, until we get to Noah, we're still left with that question that we've been wrestling with the whole time. Who's the offspring that's going to overcome temptation? Who's the one that when the serpent strikes his heel, he's going to crush his head? Who is it? And hope seems lost until we get to this phrase, but Noah. But Noah. Noah found favor. It's the same word in the Old Testament that's used to talk about grace. Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. And this is how Noah is described. A righteous man, blameless, who walked with God. Those three words literally translated mean he's a just man, he's complete, and he went with or was conversant with God. Which means he talked to God. See, Noah stood apart from the evil that surrounded him. Noah didn't go the way of the world, but he went God's way. And I think because we see the word he was conversant with God, I think it means he asked God, what way should I go? So what does this mean for all of us? Because this is some pretty deep stuff this morning. What are the modern implications? Again, I think we can come to the same conclusion that we've come to before. There are really only two ways to approach this life. There's only two ways we can approach life. One way leads to chaos and death, and the other leads to life. And the choice is ours. God's way or our way? You know, the story is the same from Genesis chapter 3. God's way or our way? See, when we look through life with our own lens, when we try to figure out how to approach life by our own inclinations, the results are disastrous. Somehow, some way, in the fall, our capacity to determine what is good, what is right, by our own set of rules and standards has been corrupted. That's what the fall has done to all of us. Our ability to decide what is good, our ability to know what is right, has been corrupted because of the fall. And we often see what we want out of life and do whatever we can to take it. We fall into the same pattern that Eve fell into, that these people in Genesis 6, we see, we covet with our eyes. That's where it starts. And I'm guilty of this. I am so guilty of this myself. You know, it's not a big secret. Barbara and I have been talking about, we'd like to get over here, we'd like to move over here. And I'll tell you what, sometimes if I'm not careful, my heart becomes bitter and covetous when I look at houses. Isn't that strange? You know, I get an email every day, here's 9 houses that you might be interested in. And I look at it, wow, that would be great. And then in my mind, I start to put together, how can I get that? And that's a dangerous path. That's a dangerous path to be on. The path that leads to order and life is one that's closely connected to God. Like Noah, we need to be walking with God. We need to be conversant with God. And what I've found in my own life, those times that I'm covetous, those times that I look at something and I think, how can I get it, are the times that I'm not talking to God enough. Those are the times that my prayer life has been slack. You know, but before we decide what's good, and in anything in life, we should seek His approval. We should ask Him what's good. I've talked about this before. There's a documentary called The Free Burma Rangers. It's about a group of, it's about an American man that went to Burma, which is Myanmar, where I spent some time. And they have a group of guys that they train, and they go into these villages where the military just, you know, goes in and kills their own people, and they try to save as many people as they can. There's one scene in this documentary where these individuals are, they've branched out now, and they're in Iraq and different parts of the world there. And there's a girl that's trapped, and they're surrounded, the rangers are surrounded by people that are shooting at them. And the American man who started this, he sees this lady out there, and in the documentary he says, I stopped and I asked God, what do you want me to do? Because he said, I knew that if I went out there, we would die. Somebody would get shot. But I asked God, what do you want me to do? And he said, I felt like Jesus said, get her. And they document how this happens. You know, that's a pretty serious situation. But I think if, even in the little things in life, if we would just approach God that same way, God, what would you like me to do? God, this looks good to me, but I know that my ability to seek good is not always great. You know, because really in life, we all need glasses. Our vision to determine what has good has been corrupted. Now, here's a comforting thing. When we get to just these first few verses, we can find comfort in knowing that God remembers those who have not set out to make a name for themselves. You know, that's what stands out to me about Noah in just these first few verses, is Noah didn't set out to make a name for himself. He's not like all those other people. He's not like those men of renown. He's not like those people that are going out and taking individuals by force. Noah didn't set out to make a name for himself. Noah was just, blameless, and he sought God. And God remembered him. He looks at those who seek His name with favor. It's so easy to get caught up in the rat race of life and try to make a name for yourself. But when we seek His name, we'll experience His favor. And this is where we're going next week. God will use chaos to confront the chaos that evil creates. Because next week, that's where we enter into extreme chaos. The undoing of everything that's been done. But right in the middle of the story, again, is the phrase, God remembered Noah, whose name means rest. Isn't that interesting? Let's pray. Father, I know that what I've said has been almost completely inadequate this morning, that this subject matter is deep, and that some of the things that we've always been taught or heard are challenged, and that our minds are completely different than the minds that originally read this or heard this for the first time. But even though we have differences, God, the message, the principles transcend all time. And I pray that as we continue to ruminate over this and to think about this, is that you would bring those principles not only to our mind, but help them settle in our heart, Father, that we would be people that, much like Noah, are set apart, not because of the name that we've strived to make for ourselves, but because we've sought after your name. And God, I pray that in my own life, when I fall short of that, that you forgive me because of the work of your Son, Jesus Christ, on the cross. As we continue to unfold the rest of this story next week, God, I pray that you would help us to see that even in the midst of chaos and pain, you are still in control. And it's in your name I pray. Amen.